Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Finally, I get round to doing something military. I've been wanting to do things like this for an age, and finally I'm getting round to it. Because military stuff, history stuff, this is important. You cannot plan for the future if you have no knowledge of the past. And the past is a wonderful record that you can learn from. But things are always evolving as well. So you cannot just look at history in isolation. You have to study history carefully and then relate it to current things. And even this silly coronavirus nonsense is itself an exercise in warfare. Because in warfare, one of the things that happens is there is disinformation, misinformation, all kinds of total chaos. Enemies are saying things, traitors are saying things, spies are doing things, all kinds of weird stuff is going on. And I'm talking about when I was a kid, and also later in my life when I lived in South Africa, you don't get all the information of what's going on because there's a lot of secrecy, and it's necessary. It's not that it's a bad thing, it's necessary in wartime. There are certain things that need to be kept secret and certain things that the public needs to know. But if you are to operate in a civil war situation, which I think is what is coming to the Western world, in civil war and race war, it's going to be even more chaotic. Because if your enemy can scare you, then he stops you from doing things. So I viewed this coronavirus nonsense as an excellent opportunity to observe things that I've never had a chance to observe in my life before. I've never been in lockdown. I've never been under a curfew where I can't go outside my house at any time. And then there's just the information or misinformation or hoax of coronavirus. How real is this thing? Is this thing even a threat? If so, what level of threat is it? And I find that people come to me with all kinds of things, and then somebody says, "Oh, but remember, 5G is a threat, and remember, this is a threat." Warfare is one of the most critical areas of study, and probably the single most fruitful area of study for survival that you can come across. Most people, most common people, don't realize that across the entire world, in every country, are multiple military colleges. A college outside of South Africa is normally also a term that's applied to what we call a university. So you have these military colleges, which are basically military universities, where officers go, young guys go, experts go, veterans go, highly intellectual and experienced people go, and they study warfare in unbelievable levels of detail. The same kind of work goes into studying war at military colleges as you get at a university. And the vast majority of people don't even know these things happen. And these experts go, some of them are military officers, others are just academics who are interested in it. And they study warfare from ancient times to modern times in a million and one different ways. And that is how armies are able to plan for the future and to anticipate the future. Now, warfare, by my definition, and I'm convinced this is the correct definition, warfare is nothing more than the ultimate form of competition. That's all it is. It's nothing more than that. It's just competition. And there's a kind of a competition that you get where two sides cannot agree on things. And I'm not going to go into all the reasons why this is so and why it will always be so. But there comes a point where people can't agree. And life is competitive. And Something I realized in my middle age as I got older was I began to realize how truly competitive the world is. I think in the last 20 years, I've really come to grasp the unbelievably competitive nature of life and the unbelievable competition that goes on at a state level, the nation state. And no matter what Jewish filth like Stefan Molyneux talks and writes, oh, the end of the state has come. States will no longer exist. Bugger off, you lying Jew. States are the only thing that exists. States are the most important thing that functions on this planet. And there are at least 200 of them, and there may be a couple more as some bigger countries break up a bit more. So what's nice about coronavirus is that you've got huge panic, all kinds of junk going on, and lots of people are believing lots of lies, and later they will discover that they're wrong. And in a situation of war, where you have chaos, where there is uncertainty, where there is enemy propaganda, where there is disinformation and deliberate lies, etc., you need to develop the various survival skills that allow you to think carefully. Because in warfare, especially if you're a soldier, and worse still if you're a commander, if you make a wrong decision, then either you can get killed or lots of other people can get killed and injured. So it's a game, and I refer to war as a game because it is technically a game. It's competitive. It's a game, though, that can get you killed. But it's an important game, and it's actually the ultimate game. It's the game which builds nations. Most every nation on the planet came into being through nothing but warfare. And in fact, in this short video, that's exactly what we're going to look at. We're going to look at a little country that got its independence. A group of people, a tribe of whites, who managed to get their own country. And how did they do it? In this age of uncertainty, and as we move forward towards more uncertainty, more instability, more chaos, which, by the way, I've always endorsed. I've always said white people must embrace the chaos. I thought long and hard about this 15 and more years ago, and I found myself continuously concluding that chaos is good for us. Chaos is healthy, and chaos will be perhaps one of the most important friends we will ever have. And whites are very adaptable. That's something I didn't know when I was young. But as I grew older, I saw how adaptable whites are. And that's especially so for the whites of South Africa. So all whites are adaptable, and we need to prepare ourselves for the chaos that's coming. And in so doing, you may find that we're going to get a lemon. And if we do it right, we're going to take this lemon and turn it into lemonade. We're going to take something that's bad for us, and we're going to turn it into something that's good for us. And this has happened before. Whites are tough, whites are determined, and whites have done these things tens of thousands of times. Something you must never concern yourself about is what your enemies think of you. If you go and look back in the history of South Africa, the Boers who set out from the Cape to try and find their own country because they were sick of living under liberal British rule, where they were equal to the blacks in the Cape in 1836, those whites set out into danger and they set out to try and create something for themselves. Those Boers, they didn't concern themselves with what others thought of them. They were focused on trying to create a future for themselves. The fact that the British came and screwed it up for them multiple times, that the Jew-ridden British would come and even steal their countries and later even invade them. The fact of the matter is, the Boers set out to create a future for themselves. They didn't ask anyone for permission, they just went and did it. And lots of excellent things came out of that. They created various countries, some lasted only a short time, others lasted a long time. They got into wars, they won some, they lost some. That's how life goes, hey? You win some, you lose some. And in the end, they still managed to regain control even of the whole of South Africa, which had never been theirs. They got control even of the British colonies, created apartheid, and they were able to rule everybody for about 46 years. And everything they did by themselves. It was private initiatives. No king came to help them. No rich man came to help them. They just made their own plans and they got on with it. And many, many other whites have done exactly the same thing. When they feel that they're in trouble, they gather together as a group and they start doing something for their survival. They start taking care of themselves. And that is how whites are. And it's a good thing. We're an adult people. We don't behave like children. We take responsibility. And you know what? Those forefathers of ours in Europe and even here in South Africa, they risked their lives. They risked their lives on dangerous ventures, which got quite a large number of them killed. But they went and they faced danger and they did their utmost. And that's where heroes and success come from. These days, too many people are engaged in what I'd call the politics of old white women. The politics of an old woman goes like this. It is a helpless kind of politics. It's, oh, they're killing us. Oh, there's no future for us. Help us, please. The children are dying. We don't have food. We don't have money. Old woman politics buys you a lot of sympathy and it gets you help up to a point. And everybody will listen to you and try to assist you in some way or get your story out. But ultimately, old woman politics can't get you a country and it can't get you freedom. Freedom, as the Americans always say, isn't free. And freedom, if you want real freedom, you have to be prepared to kill or be killed. It's as simple as that. It is those who dared and either died in the process or managed to succeed despite losses, only they are free. You can only be free by fighting for your freedom. There is no other way. You can't go to somebody and say, listen, I'd like a country. Can I have yours? Will you give it to me? I think I deserve it. I deserve at least half of it. Nobody is going to give you anything. They're not going to give you a single grain of sand. And if you go and look at history, you'll see that is how it is. And that's how it was for us in the past, and that's how it will be in the future, and that's how it's going to be for all time. So the old woman politics gets you some noise and some clucking of sympathy and a bit of money and a bit of exposure, but eventually it also leads to other things where people just tell you straight out, listen, pack your bags, get out. You don't stand a chance. Americans have told me that to my face. Others have told me that. They've said, listen, man, just leave the place. It's finished. It's over. You can't do anything. There's no hope for you. Just leave the country. Come here. Live with us. Your days are over. And one could do that. But in reality, that's also not that possible. There are lots of things that people have here in South Africa, and there's no reason to just abandon your stuff. That's not the way whites work, and there are many reasons why you fight for your freedom. but I'm not going to go into a lecture on that now. What I want to do in this case, and I've been meaning to do this for a long time, one of my best supporters is actually a Croatian. And if there's one war that I did not study and I did not take any notice of it at all, because it occurred in the early 1990s. And in the early 1990s, we in South Africa were heading into deep trouble, coming on to black rule elections in 1994. I heard about some kind of fighting going on in Europe, in the south of Europe, and I didn't care a fig. I took no notice of it. I heard all kinds of cities and places named and all kinds of things mentioned, and I didn't take 1 ounce of interest in that war. And that war was the breakup of Yugoslavia. And Yugoslavia had been a communist state which had been formed around the people that are referred to as the Slavs. That in and of itself is maybe a wrong term, but the people known as the Slavs are just another group of whites in Europe, but they're close to the Balkans, and they're in a place that has got a lot of turmoil, and it's got a lot of turmoil from centuries past. They were in an area that was invaded by the Muslims when the Muslims were a superpower. When the Ottoman Empire existed, the Ottoman Empire invaded into southeastern Europe and invaded the territories of many small groups of whites. Now, we whites are divided in many ways, just like the blacks and the Asians, into what I'd call tribes. I find the word tribe quite convenient, perhaps because I'm just more used to the term tribe being used in Africa. And there have even been people who've referred to the whites of Africa as the white tribe of Africa. For the whites outside Africa, let me explain something to you. In Africa, there are about 300 different tribes. These tribes have got different languages, different cultures, retarded cultures, in varying forms of retardation, let's put it that way. All of them retarded, but retarded in different ways. And they've got different languages, different customs, and such like. And they are not all homogeneous. The same is true for the Asians, and the same is true for whites. We are not homogeneous. We have in our history turned into tribes. And we whites were much more tribal and functioning like tribes 2,000 years ago in Europe. And we even had borders that moved and even had people that physically tried to move around. A tribe would relocate from one place to another. We weren't as nomadic. We were never quite as nomadic as the blacks. The blacks can't occupy any particular area for long. They're not able to sustain that. But whites were much more tribal, and those tribes eventually evolved into what is called the nation state. But I want to emphasize that the differences between whites, which we know as a nation state, is as intense as the differences among blacks, known as tribes. And it's the same as happens among the Asians. So you have a race of people who are basically the same, yet they have different languages, different customs. And then they also argue among each other and they start fighting among each other. And in Europe, we've had many wars between the various tribes of whites. And our wars have been more intense, and our topics and evolution has been much more intense physically and intellectually than probably anyone else. But the good side of all this fighting is that when you get a lot of chance to fight and compete and use your brain power and so forth, you also move forward faster. Plus, we also had certain codes of ethics. where we wouldn't kill women and children. If anything, if we had one tribe that defeated another tribe in more ancient times, they would go and grab the women and children for themselves. They'd raise the children as theirs, and they'd take the women as their wives. So those are the kinds of things that we used to do. And the fighting was left to the men. So when the men lose and the men are dead, the women are relocated and they find new husbands and new families and they live with their new conquerors. Europe is a place of a kind of white apartheid. It's got a kind of a white apartheid and a tribal aspect to it that is lively and vibrant. It contains lots of clashes of ideas and things, and even religions, because some of the whites in southeastern Europe, being conquered by the Ottomans, were also converted to Islam. So you actually have white people, genuinely white people, who are Muslims. And they only became Muslims because they were conquered by Muslims and they actually came to like the religion of Islam. There aren't that many of them, but they do exist and they're totally white. So we've got a very rich and vibrant history that makes for some wild, wild reading. Now the reason why I wanted to discuss Croatia a little bit, we can always come back and visit it in more detail on certain aspects. I've already seen some things where I think we need to look more closely at it, is that we whites in Africa, especially the Boers, the Boere Afrikaners, they form the biggest and most cohesive tribe in southern Africa. In that sense, the Afrikaans-speaking whites of South Africa are the sort of Germans of Africa. They form the largest group, and they thus have a lot of power in relation to the rest. Like the Rhodesians and the Portuguese, who are other white tribes of southern Africa, they also are less. But the most dominant group are the Afrikaans speakers. And the Afrikaans speakers also have specific things that they've achieved in southern Africa that are totally unique. For example, they have proven that you can create a first world country on the African continent. South Africa was the only country that had first world status in Africa ever. And that was under apartheid, and it was only for a few decades. That's gone already. That's been quietly removed. The rest of the world figured out 15 years and more ago that we're no longer first world. And very quietly rules started changing for us because they could see we're going backwards. But a totally unique achievement, totally unique, is that the whites of South Africa proved you can create a fully functioning, sophisticated, European-like country on the African continent, and it functions and works very well. That work has now been ruined, of course, by blacks, Jews, and liberals, and communists, but these whites proved it can be done. Another smaller subset of the whites in South Africa are the English-speaking whites. And they are very much linked to Jews and to trading. And they think a lot in sort of the Anglo-American business kind of a way. But these are our tribes and our sort of subsets within our tribes. And you find the same thing occurring all across Europe. And it's even more complex over there, these differences between white peoples. Now, the reason I want to talk about the Croatians a bit in this video is because for the last 20 to 25 years, there have been mumblings among whites here in South Africa, and I've grown to like this, about whites having their own country. And almost 20 years ago exactly, when I first got involved in politics in the year 2000, I began to seriously think about this concept of a whites-only country in Africa. Is it possible? Is it viable? How the heck can you do it? And can you do it when there's all kinds of enemies out there, bigger and stronger enemies, who do not want to see such a thing come into existence. And I began to think a lot about this notion of a whites-only country and how can one get it and what do you need to do. And I realized right away, I was initially under the influence of the prophecies of the Boer prophet Sinner van Rensburg, and it was quite inspirational, and I used that as the sort of basis from which to start thinking. Then later on I dumped those ideas, but I used it as a useful intellectual mechanism to start thinking about the concept of a whites-only state. And I began to do a lot of digging and thinking about military stuff, because it was apparent to me the only chance for freedom for whites in Africa is through warfare and the creation of a whites-only state. Then along came a group called the Zuidlanders, run by Gustav Muller, and later they brought in their English salesman, Simon Roche, and they came and talked a whole lot of nonsense about warfare and what you should do and shouldn't do, and it irritated me a lot because I don't like people talking a lot of junk. We need to have things that we think about firmly before we do anything. You can't act like a clown in a time when there is a life and death situation. If you operate like an idiot, you're going to get killed, or you're going to be put in jail, or you're going to be enslaved in some way. When you're in a life and death situation, you got to think clearly, and you better know your game, because your life is on the line, as is everybody else's life. So you can't go operating like an idiot. And I like military history, and I've always enjoyed it, studied it as much as I could, and I went and looked deeply into these issues. And people were saying to me, oh, well, you know, if we have to fight the blacks, we can't do this, we mustn't do that, we've got to run away, we've got to, you know, all sorts of things. The Sinner van Rensburg crowd would say, all the whites are going to be killed in Johannesburg. Johannesburg, by the way, is like the New York of Africa. We've got about 2 million whites here. I'm guessing, the best guess I've got is that between Johannesburg and Pretoria, we've got about 2 million whites and about 20 million blacks in the same area. So it's the most densely populated area, but it's also the biggest and most massive built-up area. It can take you well over an hour. It can take you almost 2 hours of driving to go from the west of Johannesburg to the east of Johannesburg. On highways, it'll take you almost 2 hours of driving. That's how big it is. You're looking at an area that's almost 200 kilometers across. And it's all built up. Lots and lots of infrastructure because of all these blacks. You've got like 20 million people here. You've got more people here than the population of Holland. So people were saying to me, oh God, you know, get out of the cities. People still say that. Get out of the cities. Run away. The blacks are just going to come and kill you all. And I've even heard that out of the mouths of communists. In fact, I'm still going to put up the audio of a direct discussion with the Jew, Ronnie Kasrils, who was a government minister in South Africa, and he was the Minister of Intelligence. He had an extremely high position. A true communist Jew, a white-hating communist Jew. And I had a bit of a discussion with him, and it's recorded. And you're going to hear him say exactly that. He talks about, oh, well, the blacks are maybe just going to kill all the whites, and that's that. Now, those kinds of statements made by people believing in prophecy, made by an enemy of the whites, a Jew, a true Jew communist, one of the most hardcore Jewish communists, those kinds of statements need to be analyzed and studied. And that's the kind of thing I want to show people. We're going to study war, race war, future war, past war. We're going to study these different things because these are the mechanisms by which the politics of the white male functions. The white man's politics is different to the old woman politics. The white man's politics works like this. I know what I want, and I'm going to get it, despite the fact that you don't want me to get it. I intend getting it over your cold, dead body. And if I fail, I'll be dead. But one way or the other, that's how I'm going to approach this. And I obviously don't want to die, so I'm going to do my utmost to ensure that when I do this, it's going to be over your dead body. You don't ask permission when you're a man. You do. You do what you think you need to do. You take your decisions and you make it happen. And if you fail, you might be dead or your arms or legs might be shot off. But that's how a man approaches these problems. And that is how our race has approached these problems hundreds of thousands of times. Our history is so rich in these struggles that if I say 100,000 times, I'm not lying to you. Whites have done unbelievable numbers of things. If there's a race who's experienced at survival and reality and facing all kinds of difficult things, it's ours. We've done this across the planet. And we've ruled more than half of this planet. Just over 100 years ago, most of this planet was under the direct rule of whites. And that included every inch of Africa almost. And so people then say to me, you know, it's impossible. You know, the blacks outnumber us 10 to 1, 11 to 1 actually. The blacks outnumber us. There's no hope in hell. We cannot win. It's totally impossible. You cannot do these things. Just cannot, cannot, cannot. They're just going to come. They're going to kill us all. We're all going to die, and that's that. And the only way that we're going to survive is to flee, run, 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 run on the prairies, run into the mountains, run and hide. That's the only way you're going to survive. Well, if you've studied military history, you'll find that that's just total junk. That's just complete and utter rubbish. That is not how things work. That in actual fact, if you sit and you apply your mind and your body and you think carefully and you prepare carefully, that in actual fact, there are many things you can do, even when you're completely outnumbered. Ask the Germans. The Germans have fought wars where probably nobody was more outnumbered than the Germans. Mind you, even the British have had their moments at places like Rorke's Drift, where the British were outnumbered tremendously. So our race has got a lot of experience. And how does warfare actually work? Can you do something? And the whites here say, well, but we're only 4 million and they're 50 million. What can 4 million do? You know, it's so hopeless. But if you go and you study our actual wars, like in the lecture that I gave, 50 years of race war in Southern Africa, where I gave a detailed rundown of all the wars that the whites fought in Southern Africa. And by the way, I'll still turn that into a DVD, which I'd like to sell, because I put masses of work into that thing. And I still want to do follow-ups on that thing. It's very important. When I did the 50 years of race war in Southern Africa stuff, I showed people that look at all the times that we won. Look at all the odds that we overcame. It's not like we don't know how to fight. We've fought these blacks before. We've fought them a lot. And they came off second best many times, even when they outnumbered us, even when they had all kinds of superior advantages to us. So I don't see any reason why, based on practical experience, why we should just give up on ourselves. And then I began to think to myself, what situations are there that are similar to what we might face in the future? Now, the original situation which I found, and which I need to do a video on very shortly now, because we really need to roll along with these topics, was Angola. The Portuguese fought in Angola, and they fought the most brutal race war that's ever been fought between blacks and whites anywhere. They fought it in Angola. And as happens in warfare, there comes a time where each side tries something different. And one time, the blacks got very, very bold. And the blacks came to try and wipe out all the whites. And that's the next topic I want to touch on, is the actual battles that raged when the blacks did try to come and wipe out all the whites. And then I thought in more recent times, I came across this little video that I'm going to show you. It's called The Summer of 95. And we're not going to look at the beginning of the Croatian War of Independence, which started in about 1990 or so. We're actually going to look at the end of the War of Independence. So we're going to go to the end first, because I want to show you something. And when I came across this Croatian thing, I then sent it to my Croatian supporter and I said, "Is this really what happened in Croatia? Am I correct in saying that this is stuff from Croatia?" And my friend said, "Yes, we had a dreadful war there." And then I began to investigate it, and to my amazement, I found that here is a little tribe that has got a population that's almost identical to the population of the whites of South Africa. That we've got exactly the same sized population, and they were caught in a nasty situation. There are things, as always in history, history is very rich in all kinds of differences and similarities. There were things that the Croatians had that were going well for them, but the Croatians also had some mistakes. And by the way, another group of whites who in modern times did a fantastic thing are the people of Finland. The whites of Finland also fought a war that was almost beyond belief. But that's a topic for another day. And they're also a small tribe of whites. Now, the Croatians, this Croatian war is much more in modern times. It's from 1990 to about 1995, and it's their war of independence. And it's how they became independent in this time when slowly Yugoslavia started falling apart. So the first similarity to the whites of South Africa is we've got the same number of people. So here's a little tribe that numbers almost exactly the same as us. For example, the Croatian population in 1990 was 4.7 million people. And the population of whites in South Africa now is 4.5 million people, a little bit over 4.5 million people. So our tribal size is almost exactly the same. The only other tribe that I know of that's of a similar size is New Zealand, with 4.7, almost 4.8 million people. But that includes non-whites. So if you had to pull out the non-whites, their population would be closer to the size of the whites of South Africa. So New Zealand and Croatia are two white countries that have got a population that is very, very similar, almost identical to that of South Africa. And so we can look at them and we can see some of the similarities and we can start inferring some things about ourselves. Because what would we be like if we got rid of these blacks, stopped using these blacks, had nothing to do with these blacks in Africa, and we just functioned as a whites-only group? No more dependence on blacks, no more black labor, we got to do everything ourselves. Are we enough to actually form some kind of country? If so, what can we do? What would we be capable of? What would our GDP be? What are the things that could work for us? So I wanted to use these comparisons, and here were the Croatians, who not only had the same population, but they'd fought a war, and the war was fought in more modern times with weapons that are not that dissimilar to what we would have to fight a war with. So I began to look more closely at the Croatians. And already I could see a number of things. And even as I was like looking more deeply into the Croatian data, I spotted stuff that I'd been thinking of in some of my arguments with all these people, all these naysayers who say you mustn't do this, you must do that, they are talking about things that I know from military history, from my general studies of military history, you don't do these things. That is not the right way to approach it. That strategy will not work. And to my amazement, things that I'd been telling people and which people have been rejecting again and again here in South Africa. Just the other day, I was studying another aspect of the Croatian War, and I found, to my amazement, a perfect example of exactly what I'd been talking about for years and which I'd been telling people about, and everybody tells me, you can't do this, and yet the Croatians did it. And it's right there in your face. Everything that I said, and you can see how it pans out in the war, and you can see that, yes, this approach does have lots of merit. And the Croatians went and tried it, and you can see the results for yourself. And it ties up with the rest of military history. So there's so much that can be proven, and you can prove it from different wars and why it's doing different things. But I just loved it that this was in the Croatian sense. And we'll look at that particular aspect of it in a bit more detail. Because you'll see that certain battles in Croatia went exactly the same as certain battles in Angola, went exactly the same as certain battles that the Germans fought, and so on. And then you start seeing, yes, you know, this technique works. That way of approaching it is better than the silly ideas of people interpreting prophecies. And better still, when you have the freaking film footage of it. Now you can actually see it, and you can see it with modern weapons, and you can see what happens. So the Croatians, like the Finns, when the Finns got into their big trouble, the Croatians, like the Finns, were a peaceful group of whites. They're a little tribe, very peaceful. In fact, the Croatians have got another similarity to the white South Africans. The Croatians are deeply Christian. I think they are Catholic, I think. Could be wrong, but I think. But they are deeply Christian. So they are deeply, deeply Christian, and they're a pretty peaceful people. Another aspect of the Croatians is that the Croatians have a long history of being allies of the Germans. And even in World War II, they were immediate allies of the Germans. And they have 800 years of history of alliance with Germany. Now, in South Africa, the whites in South Africa, even these prophecy whites, they've been talking continuously about having an alliance with Germany. That in the future, when we create this whites-only state, that we want to be allied with Germany. Germany is the biggest country that we want to have on our side. That is very important for us, because we're not going to get it from Britain and America. They are never going to allow whites-only states. But the dream over here among the whites is Germany. And the whites here also generally have good relations with Europe. And in my 50 years of race war in Southern Africa, I also pointed out all the countries that helped us from Europe. And all the countries that helped the whites of Southern Africa, all of them were Europeans. We didn't get one weapon from America. We didn't get one weapon from the British. But we got lots of help from Europeans. And I will tell you that the secret of Southern Africa is that the French, were the friendliest to all the whites of Southern Africa, France. Of all the nations in Europe, the one that stood by us the most, the one that helped us the most, in the most intensive ways, in military matters and scientific matters, was France. In fact, nuclear power in South Africa comes directly from the French. But the French helped all of us. They helped the Rhodesians, they helped the Portuguese, they helped the South Africans. Italy was another one. Portugal was our great ally because Portugal was also in the region. Spain was friendly as well. Even a little bit of Western Germany was trying to help us a little bit on the quiet there. The only friends that we had in the world, real friends that helped us with weaponry, that helped us with various things, were Europeans. Rhodesia did sanctions busting by traveling, sending planes to Europe to do secret deals. South Africa was striking secret deals, and so on. And of course, the Portuguese have always been close to us because they are the whites. They are the only whites of Europe who actually fought in Africa against the blacks. They were excellent friends, and we never had any problems with the Portuguese. But the Spaniards were there too. The Spaniards were also very friendly, etc. We had friends, and they were in Europe, even if they were covert in certain ways. But quietly, we had friends. And even the Japanese helped us. Even the Japanese. The Japanese had good relations with Rhodesia. They had good relations with South Africa, with apartheid South Africa. And the Japanese were declared to be honorary whites under apartheid. Japanese were treated like white people. Chinese and Indians were treated like black people. And I think that those assessments were dead on and can continue in the future. The Japanese are great. Turning to the Croatians and the Finns, when they had big problems, both of their little nations were not armed and prepared for war. When the Finns were facing the Russians, they weren't prepared for war. They'd been very liberal. They'd let their little army go to waste. The Croatians also didn't have an army. And suddenly, in a short space of time, they found that they needed weapons. And both the Croatians and the Finns had to deal with invasions where the other side has got the military force and they've got to quickly work out things. But we're going to focus more closely on the Croatians. The struggle for Croatian independence starts as a political game in what was Yugoslavia. And the Serbs, who are a much bigger tribe, the Serbs are another tribe of whites, and they are 7.5 million. So the Croatians were 4.7 million back then. So in terms of people, the Serbs had about 60% more people than the Croatians. And the Serbs became their main enemy. Now, what helped the Croatians was that Yugoslavia had been divided into states, like the USA. And these states had elections. And the Croatians had their own Croatian state, but it also had some Serbs living in it. And there were Croatians living in other states. But the majority of people in the Croatian state were Croatians. So you had these states that existed as part of Yugoslavia, but they didn't have their own armies. They were like America, where you have different states and the state has a lot of power. Originally, states in America had a lot of power. It wasn't the central government that had power. And a similar sort of situation almost existed at the end of Yugoslavia. So the whites lived in a contiguous piece of territory, and they had their own political party and their own leader. But they weren't independent. They were still part of Yugoslavia. However, they didn't have their own army, but they did have a police force. And when the war broke out, the Serbs had control of the entire Yugoslavian army. So these Croatians found themselves with 70,000 policemen with very little weapons, and the Serbs, controlling the Yugoslavian army, had an army of 145,000 men. And it was a proper army, man. It had tanks, it had aircraft, it had artillery. They had a navy with ships, because part of Croatia's a long coastline. So here were the Croatians, who are outnumbered against the Serbs anyway, but the Serbs have got control of the Yugoslavian army, and the Croatians have nothing. They've just got light weaponry, no real army, just some police. And they then decide to secede, which is also what the whites of Southern Africa have been talking about. Secession. How do you do secession? Well, the Croatians could see that there were going to be problems, and they began to quietly try and prepare themselves, and then their political leaders and everybody, they decided to secede. And that was basically the beginning of the events that led to the war. So here you have a population that's very similar in size to ours, and they don't really have an army, but they've got a lot of policemen. And by the way, in South Africa, we've got lots of whites who either were in the military or who were in the police. Lots used to be in the police. So we've got a pretty similar situation. And the Croatians didn't have heavy weaponry. In fact, right throughout their war, the one weapon that the Croatians never really had was aircraft, can you believe? They really struggled with aircraft. Later, they managed to get other weapons, all kinds of other weapons. But the one weapon that the Croatians really didn't have was an air force, even during the war. They really battled hard, whereas the other side had jet aircraft and bombers and everything. Now, as happens in war, and which I was well aware of when I started writing about warfare and fighting, is that when you're in a real survival situation and you really don't have things and you could get killed very shortly, you make a lot of plans quickly and you improvise as fast as you can. And that is one area where the Croatians were absolutely fantastic, was in their improvisation. And again, if you go and you study the wars of the whites in Southern Africa, you'll see that we were good at improvisation. In fact, when it comes to speed of improvisation in hour of need, I think the Rhodesians are in a class of their own in Southern Africa. We didn't have the heavy weaponry that we needed, and we had to improvise a heck of a lot of things that we had never expected to come our way. So Rhodesia did a lot of improvisation. South Africa had much more time to prepare and was much more advanced and had been thinking ahead. And South Africa wasn't caught as off guard. But even later, South Africa also improvised all kinds of strange things, and their improvisations were fantastic. Their improvisations weren't the quick, simple, rapid things that Croatians and Rhodesians did. Their stuff was higher caliber, higher quality, and with a lot better science and engineering behind it. And some of their stuff was incredible. When it actually went into battle, there were things the South African army did that shouldn't have been physically possible. And the same is true for the Rhodesians as well. There were things that we did that nobody would have thought we could do beforehand. Nobody could even have conceived of it. And the South African army did a lot of that in some hectic fighting. Now the Croatians also, they had quick improvisation of simple things, and they moved fast. They thought quickly and they did all kinds of things, and they had to try and obtain weapons while they're under attack, etc., etc. And they did really well. They did really well. But I don't want to go into those things yet. I want to show you the end result. Because the Croatians, in their struggle that lasted 5 years of war, in that struggle, there are 2 points I want to make to you. The first point is the Croatians, with their 70,000 policemen and their quickly, hurriedly formed little army of volunteers, etc., and guys with old weapons and no weapons, etc., The first problem they faced was a attack by this army of 145,000 men coming at them from many different directions. It's in that sense similar to the kind of scenario that whites fear in South Africa. And that would be a kind of a worst case scenario. What happens if the enemy's got a big army and they're hitting you from all sides at the same time? Now, one thing I want to tell you in my studies of military history and my conclusions is that if you've got 70,000 whites like you have in Croatia who are badly armed and they're facing a proper army of professional white soldiers, the Serbians, the Serbians are not to be sneezed at. The Serbians are capable, well-trained, well-armed whites. They are freaking dangerous. To face an army of 145,000 white males with proper weaponry, properly trained, intelligent white males, that is not the same as facing an army of 145,000 blacks. In fact, I would say to you that you would need to multiply that number by a minimum of 3. And even if you multiply that army by 3, you are still wrong in your numbers. In other words, what I'm trying to get at is the firepower of the Serbs with the Croatian army. How can you try and draw a conclusion out of this? And here's what I'm telling you, is that for the Croatians to face 145,000 whites is at the very least the same as facing 145,000 times 3 blacks. In other words, I'm saying that to face 145,000 well-armed whites is the same as facing an army of 430,000 well-armed blacks. In fact, I would go so far as to say that you could even multiply it by 5. And I know there are all kinds of people who will say, no, that's crazy, that's crazy. How could we fight so many blacks? But I've studied my warfare and I'm willing to bet my own life on it. I personally think that we should multiply the number by 5. And just for fun, 145,000 times 5 is 720,000. So I'm saying to you that that Serbian army, if translated into African strength, the kind of strength that we'd face in Africa, you're looking at the same thing as being attacked by 720,000 blacks. That's what I'm saying. But since many of you will say, no, this has got to be wrong, we will reduce it to 3 times the number. We will say, okay, it's the same as being attacked by 430,000 armed blacks. Not unarmed blacks with sticks and stones, armed blacks with actual rifles, with actual military equipment. Fighting against blacks in Africa versus fighting whites in Europe is not the same thing. Those whites know what they're doing. These blacks are clowns. And I'm sure that if they formed an army, their army would be chaotic and there'd be many problems with it. And that's all I'm going to say at this point. It's something I've thought about a heck of a lot. And I'm just going to say to you, this is the way I see it. Take it or leave it. But later on, you'll see me make other points in more detail. So I'm saying that for those Croatians, it's the same as being attacked by 430,000 blacks with AK-47s, with tanks, with artillery, with whatever they've got. It's the same kind of thing. And none of you would even conceive that the blacks, if they attacked us in that quantity, that we'd even last a day. You would say, the blacks are just going to come, they're going to kill us all, we'll all be dead, we're gone, game over. And I'm going to say to you, no, it doesn't work that way in actual warfare. It doesn't work that way. And we still have plenty of things working for us. So that is the way that I see it from my military history studies. And as time goes by, I'll make point after point, and I will show you in detail, step by step, why I am convinced this is the case. And I want to use it as a way of drawing a parallel between the kind of fighting force the Croatians had to face versus what we could face if we needed to. If we were in their spot, you know, how would we do? Now, the advantage they have is they had already got a political structure. They were living in a close proximity to each other. We, on the other hand, are much more spread out. We aren't an official state. But every problem was made to be solved, and there are many ways of getting around things. One of the problems the Croatians had to overcome, and they did it in various ways, was how do you arm yourself? Arming themselves was a real problem, but they took advantage of certain things, and they managed to arm themselves quite well. In fact, my Croatian supporter also told me that at the beginning of the war, they were so desperate for money for weapons that Croatians inside and outside Croatia were busy drawing on their savings and giving each other money so that they could form a fund and try and buy weapons, because they needed to get weapons. They needed to get weapons in order to arm themselves because they were under attack. So people are starting to pull money out of their savings, asking friends, please help donate. We need guns, we need bullets, you know, we need ammunition. And that's the kind of situation that they were in. And you will find that there are other wars that you can look at where you'll find people unprepared. There's even a very interesting black civil war that took place in Africa where one black army invaded another black country, and the blacks that were being invaded had zero weapons, zero weapons. And the blacks also had to improvise. Can you believe that the blacks improvised a little bit? And you can actually see the simple things the blacks did that kept them alive for a time. So these are normal situations that do happen to nations, where a tribe of people are attacked, even in the modern day, and they're attacked and they hardly have weapons, and they've got to run around like crazy trying to find weapons, trying to form an army on the spur of the moment. And what do you do? Well, I tell you, you don't just drop dead. People make plans, and whites get things done. So one of the problems that we whites in Africa face is the need to arm and to be able to arm ourselves properly in the future. And in that sense, we're much like the situation that the Germans found themselves in at the end of World War I, where the Germans were forbidden from having an army bigger than a certain size. They were forbidden from having tanks, aircraft, etc. They were without all the weapons that are really important that you really need. How did the Germans rearm themselves? Well, that is one of the greatest pieces of genius of any nation ever, was how the Germans managed to arm themselves before World War II. Everything that the Germans did was so brilliantly done. They were not allowed to have anything, and yet they did all kinds of impossible, illegal things, and they got it right. The Croatians, like the Finns, weren't in such a situation, and for them, especially the Croatians, for them it was a wild rush to try and work out plans on the spur of the moment. So now we're going to get to the summer of 95, final victory. 5 years, you have a people who hardly have an army, they have got 70,000 police, very few weapons, facing an army of 145,000 whites, complete with tanks, ships, aircraft, bombers, rockets, you name it. And what are they like by the summer of 95? Well, by the summer of 95, with a lot of political wrangling and military fighting. And I do want to say something here about the politics. The politics of the Croatian War of Independence is incredibly fascinating. I normally don't like politics, but I want to tell you, it's damn fascinating. It's actually some of the most cunning politics I've ever come across in my life, on the part of the Croatians and on the part of the Serbs. You've got two groups of whites playing a game of chess, and it's a dangerous game of chess and how they play this game. And I want to tell you, each was up to the game of the other. It was one hectic game. And I think that the whites of South Africa, we in South Africa, we can learn so much just from the game of chess that they played politically. The game of chess is one of the most brilliant pieces of moves that I've ever come across, and from such a small group of whites. Really, these people were really doing all kinds of things. They were pushing things to the edge, both sides. And you can say, well, this side was a little bit nasty there, and that side was a little bit not too good over there, but that is life. That is life. But the game of chess, the determination and the cunning that went into their game of chess, political game of chess, was damn good. It was really good. And then in between this, there was the fighting. By 1995, the Croatians had gone from 70,000 policemen to an army, a proper army of 200,000 white men. And by then, they had tanks. The only weakness that I can see that they didn't have was aircraft. They had very little air power, even at the end. But they had tanks, they had some artillery, and they were a proper army. 5 years of struggle, thousands dead. And by the way, 15,000 Croatians died in the war. About 8,500 of them were troops. Compare that. And now I'm going to give you a little bit of proof of what I'm saying about whites versus blacks. How many troops of the South African army died in 30 years of war? Well, the actual number is somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500. In 30 years of war against blacks, low intensity war, not high intensity war the way whites fight it, low intensity war, the actual number of battle casualties of the South African army, even fighting tank battles and other things against blacks and even against Eastern Europeans, the total deaths of the South African army was 2,500 and most likely less, probably closer to 2,000. And the casualties of the White Army of Rhodesia in the Rhodesian War was 1,200. So the fact is that when we fought the blacks, even when we fought for 10 years, our casualties were much, much lower than the Croatians fighting other whites, which is why I repeat to you the fact that fighting other whites is a way more dangerous exercise. These Croatians had a lot of guts to do this. And when you see some of the battle footage and some of the places where they fought, you'll see that when whites fight, they really fight. White people, white men, whether they're Croatians, whether they're Serbs, whether they're Germans, whether they're Spaniards, French, Italians, Portuguese, white males don't fuck around. When white men fight, they really fight. And you will see what that country looked like. A huge part of the economy imploded during the war, but the Croatians hung in there. 5 years later, 8,500 soldiers dead and about 6,500 civilians dead. Not that many civilians died. Soldiers were dying. Soldiers were protecting the civilians. And by the way, don't just think that it's just the blacks who can massacre. Whites also can massacre and have massacred. And by the way, Christians don't know this, but Christians have massacred people. Christians have massacred pagans. Christians have massacred other white Christians. That exists in history. You can go and read the atrocities of white Christians against other white Christians in Europe. So don't think that massacre doesn't happen in a whites-on-whites war, especially when it's as bitter as that between the Croatians and the Serbs. There were massacres there where sides went and they killed civilians of the other side after the fighting. And there were a bunch of massacres that were perpetrated in that war. Massacres that were far worse than the much vaunted, Sharpeville massacre. The Jews, liberals, and communists and blacks never stopped moaning and groaning about the Sharpeville massacre. Total deaths are like less than 70. You'll see in white wars, whites massacring whites at times, and it's much more that get killed than in blacks trying to massacre whites, etc. So these whites, they didn't have some wussified, sissified little war. These whites had a serious war, and they were full of real anger, make no mistake. And at times, when one side or the other side captured a town or a village, they killed all the people of the other side. So it was brutal, man. It was brutal. It was no mucking around. And after all that fighting, for that population of 4.2 million people, 15,000 of their people had been killed. They'd taken some serious beatings from an army that was very superior to theirs. 5 years later, you find that the 70,000 badly armed policemen have been transformed into 200,000 white males, complete with tanks, rockets, and the only thing that they were really short of was aircraft. But other than that, they even had a little navy. And you see a proper army that has fought a proper war, that has got battle experience, a hardened army of white males, massed army of white males. So let's go back to South Africa. We have the same population as the Croatians. How big could our army be? Well, why couldn't we have an army of 200,000? Why couldn't we? If them, with their population, and they're not particularly rich, I might add, they're not particularly rich. Those Croatians, pretty common, ordinary white Europeans, they had an army of 200,000 trained, battle-hardened white males after 5 years of fighting. 200,000. Imagine if we whites of Southern Africa could build an army of 200,000 men. We've got the same population as theirs. That shows you that we could have an army of 200,000 white men. And imagine we could arm our army properly. There would be nobody in Southern Africa who could take us on. All these blacks from all these other black states could try and fight us all at the same time. And our army would be able to beat them off. They'd need to bring in Chinese and goodness knows what if they were to even try to stand a chance against us. So what can a nation of 4.5 million people do? 4.5 million whites who are not particularly well off? You can have a freaking army of 200,000 men with proper weapons. And I'm going to show you some combat footage from the final summer of 95. And we white men, we don't know what victory looks like anymore. Ever since World War II, Virtually every war has been one losing streak on top of another. What does white victory actually look like? Are there white men who actually know what it feels like to win? Are there white men who actually can say, I fought for the independence of my country and I won? Well, the Croatians can. And you're going to see them, you're going to see their faces, and you're going to look at them and you're going to see some pretty ordinary, not too well off white guys. But you know what? They can walk tall because they've done something that most of us will never be able to do and have never done and can only dream of. And when you look at the film footage, it's set to some pop music, and I've left it as it is. I quite enjoy it the way it is. But look at those men. Look at how they cheer each other on. How they cheer each other on. You can see some of them are a bit tired, but they show their V for victory. You'll also see how shot up some of the places are. And you'll even get little bits of combat footage. And my particular favorite, I love their armor, but my particular favorite is their rocket launcher. Watch their rocket launcher vehicle go into action. Boy, would I love to see a rocket launcher like that here in Africa sending some medicine to the blacks. These spoiled brat blacks who've had it so good for so long and could not stop complaining about every aspect of apartheid. What is it like to be on the receiving end of some real military treatment? That is what we should be dealing out to them. And if you look carefully, you'll even see some guys with various camouflage on their faces. Some of it black, and you'll see some very happy white guys. They're armed and ready to rock and roll. They know what they're doing, and they're happy. The taste of victory is sweet after all that struggle. The Romans used to say, the smell of the corpses of your enemies is sweet. That is how the Romans felt about it. So to sum up, by the summer of 1995, the Serbs had had many of their problems elsewhere, and the Serbs could only field an army of 50,000. But by then, the Croatians were 200,000. So again, with my 3-to-1 rule, which I still think is far too favorable to the blacks, actually, as by my 3-to-1 rule, I would say 200,000 Croatians attacking 50,000 Serbs and kicking their asses right out of Croatia quickly and neatly. It was a stunning final victory for the Croatians. Well, that would be the same as 200,000 white men facing at least 150,000 blacks. Personally, I believe we do it to even larger numbers. But facing, let's say, for argument's sake, we'll give the blacks the benefit of the doubt. We'll say that's the same as 200,000 white guys taking on 150,000 blacks and kicking their fucking asses right out of there. Kicking their asses out and smashing them in one shot. That is the kind of firepower we could have. So don't tell me, what can we do? We're going to be left to die. We will die. The blacks will kill us all. I will show you step by step. We'll go and study Angola. We'll study various battles. And I will show you piece by piece how you can fight these people and win. How we can fight these blacks. Everybody thinks the blacks are going to come to kill us. The blacks might find that they're in for the nightmare of their life. But look at the face of white victory. What does white victory look like? Look at those guys. That is victory. And all white males need to aim for that. We need victories like that everywhere. Across Europe, across America, in Africa, we need to beat our enemies back. We don't ask our enemies, can we have freedom? Can we have independence? We seize it over their dead bodies. That's how you get freedom. You kill them, and then you're free. That is how freedom actually works. And to repeat, as the Americans say, freedom isn't free. You got to fight for it. If you don't fight for it, you're never going to get it. Nobody's going to come and give it to you on a plate. While the Croatians have some things that went better for them than for us, we've also got some of our own advantages. And among our advantages is the fact that we fought blacks for decades. And we've had blacks coming and attacking us and trying to steal from us and murder us for decades. So we've got lots and lots of experience about how they work and what they do and what they're capable of. That is knowledge that the Croatians did not have. But we've got lots of knowledge of our enemy. Lots. So look at these Croatians, and may there be white victory for whites everywhere on earth from now on. Only white men with other white men. And later I will discuss with you the value of a man. Because what is messing up your head is the concept of the value of a man. And that is why I say the things I say about the blacks. I don't buy into their value. I say that those ratios I'm giving you are much closer to the truth. In fact, I'm giving the blacks the benefit of the doubt, even though you don't think that. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. I reckon we could kick their asses even more than that. But that's how I think. And I'll show you that I'm not just dreaming this up. I'm not just sucking this out of my thumb. And I'll be honest with you, whenever I watch this, I get a lump in my throat. I really feel for those guys. And may there be many, many more white victories for white males everywhere. Everybody's got to be thinking of things like this. This is what all white men have to do. Whether they live in America, Canada, Britain, Europe, this is the path to victory. This is how we need to deal with all these non-whites who are threatening us. That is how you're going to beat them and whip their asses. Learn from the tiny Croatian army. This is the face of white victory.
Yeah.
On my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.